Hey everyone, it's Dimpna here. What we're going to talk about today is a problem that came up the other day when I was talking to one of my students. And we were talking about a particular deal that she wanted to go and do. And she said, okay, well, I'm flying up there to go and have a look at the property and, you know, it's this and it's that and all these things. And she said, what else do I need to look at? And I went through a whole list of other things that she needed to consider and make sure that she was right with the figures on and people to talk to, etc. And then just a throwaway line, I said, oh, just make sure it's not in a floodplain. And she said, oh, yeah, right. And she's writing all of this stuff down. Well, she texts me back about, probably 3/4 of an hour later, and she said, I've just cancelled my flights. It floods, it's this, it's that. She said, thank you so much. I was about to make an offer on it. And it really brought to the fore the need to have a really good due diligence checklist. So I thought what I'd do today is not actually go through all of that, but just give you a few pointers on some of the things that you need to do from a due diligence perspective. When you've found something that you think you're a little bit interested in, what are some of the things that we need to consider? So I thought we'd just have a little bit of a discussion on that, and to help me out, I have my good mate here, Ian Ugarte.
Hi, how are you going? I'm a good mate today.
You're a good mate today.
I'm also still a student. So I'm a good mate and student, apparently.
Well, sometimes I call him my star student, sometimes I call him my good mate. Sometimes I call him other things, yes, which you don't want to hear.
You get that.
Okay, let's get on to the game at hand here. Now, when we're doing due diligence, the first thing that you need to really get your head around is the fact that you need to secure the property wherever possible and have some get out of jail clauses in your contract so that then you can start your investigation process to be able to, either pull out of the contract or go forward with the contract or even reduce the purchase price on the contract. Now, that's a little bit difficult across the different states because they have different laws. Now, Ian, you're from New South Wales, and you and I have this bit of a semi-argument with each other, and it's not about the state of origin.
Come second anyway on that one.
It's more about the New South Wales contract laws and how I am dead against them, don't like them at all, and you're kind of, well, they have their benefits.
Yeah, well, for me, I mean, the contract law in New South Wales essentially says you need to do all your due diligence and upfront before you go signing a contract. You do have some period of time in the at the beginning of the contract, which it sometimes could be around 5 days, but there's penalties of still pulling out of that contract. So,
0.25%, is it?
0.025% of the purchase price. So it's still hurt money, but more the hurt money is more about the fact that you might send out specific professionals to do some tasks on the job before you've even purchased it, before you can even make an offer. So it can sometimes cost you $4,000 or $5,000, and you may not end up purchasing the property. And if you do, there's no get out of jail card on them, usually. For me, you know, that's not good for a purchaser, and on my side of the fence as a purchaser, you know, I always want to make sure that it's easy for me, and that doesn't help me in any way in New South Wales in particular.
So in New South Wales, what we're saying is that you can contract on a property, have a signed contract from the buyer and the seller is under no legal obligation to sell it to you. He can go and sign another contract with somebody else and what we call gazump you.
Yeah, so there is a process that's called exchanging in New South Wales, where literally the contracts are put over the top of each other, and if both of them have signed and then the exchange occurs, well, now you're in a contract.
That means that you're unconditional.
Yeah, you're unconditional, you're in, you can't pull out.
Whereas in all the other states, you can sign a contract on a property and have certain clauses in there, like subject to finance and subject to pest and building and subject to even to a due diligence clause if you want to have it in there. And provided the seller's happy with the clauses, he'll sign. And that means you've got a period of time, which is laid out in the contract, for you to go through your investigative process, whether you can get finance, whether it's, whether you can get a DA on it or anything else you're going to do with that property. And the seller cannot sell it to anybody else during that period of time. Then the dates come up basically, and then you can go unconditional on the contract, which means the buyer and the seller have to proceed with the contract.
Yeah, and that's great for the purchasers in the other states, but for the sellers, you know, so the sellers are hanging in limbo there, waiting for that date to tick over so they can finally say, well, I definitely know the house is sold now.
It's similar in New South Wales, though.
Yes, but it's the opposite in New South Wales. So the opposite in New South Wales is that once you sign a contract, the seller is quite comfortable with the fact that it's almost too difficult to pull out of the deal. So the purchaser's going ahead from the beginning, and the seller can then go off and make their plans, whereas in the other states, the seller's usually waiting to make their plans.
To get to the time
to
of...
To the time, yeah.
Unconditional.
And quite often, I know I deal with it often, that a New South Wales person has to, buying in another state, has to be wary, and the other way around as well. So, and you can get yourself in trouble. So, go on.
You really got to know the laws in the state in which you're buying the property to really get a handle on what the way things have to be done. I mean, I see it all the time. You get people from New South Wales come up and buy property in Queensland and the other states, and they dilly-dally around and they go and get their finance and then they go and get this one and all the other stuff done. Meanwhile, somebody else has come and put a contract on the property and they've got the first right on that property.
Yeah.
Whereas in New South Wales, the other way around, you've got to be sharp on it. You've got to get yourself done. You've got to be ready to go. You've got to have pre-approvals. You've got to be so much more prepared in New South Wales because you're probably going to have to exchange that much sooner.
Yeah, and that's the great advantage that I found, one of the great advantages of being a student, that, you know, I could get on the website, your members only website, and get on to contacts that are specifically around that. So all the legal people that speak the language of Dimpna, then
I've got my own language.
You've got your own language. and, you know, so I knew from that I had access to people in every state that would help me out and make sure that I wasn't going to make any mistakes. And that's part of the due diligence process. Your solicitor or legal person is important part of that process because they're going to be ones that would do the searches on your behalf to make sure that there's not some of the things that are wrong for a particular property. And there's many things. What you've got to be prepared for is to tell the solicitor everything about the property because they're not physically going out there. And so some of the things, Dimpna's already mentioned flood, and you might look at roadways, you might look at covenants, you might look at a demolition controls over the properties, heritage listing, you know,
surveys,
all those sort of stuff. You might have a caveat on your property too, and you're not aware of them. So, you know, that legally can stop you from buying it, or if you buy it, it could put you in a different position. So all that part of the due diligence, that having the right legal people in train for you to move forward is really important.
One of the things I'm going to do at the upcoming Fast Profits is, particularly when we start talking about commercial deals and things like that, is look at how you can protect your risk at every next benchmark. So contractually, you are protected to proceed to the next level. And that's one of the things that, particularly as the deals get more complex, as you progress through the property journey, if you like, you need to become more educated and more switched on. That use the tools that are available to you to really, really protect every angle of possibilities that can happen with a property. And this is, you know, there's such a difference between somebody just going out and buying a property and suck it and see, really, is what a lot of people do. They buy a negatively geared investment property. They suck it and see as to whether the property is going to go up or not in value. And that's their only plan, you know, that hopefully it's going to go up in value. And it's just so wrong. This is where, you know, you need to be contractually protected. You need to protect contractually the intention or your intention on the property and the strategy that's going to be put on that property, and really give yourself the opportunity to get the best performance out of a property, not just sit back and wait for it to go up. That's like the worst, most boring strategy there is.
Yeah, and so when you're looking at those decision-making processes come down to education. So many people make a decision about buying property and their due diligence is literally reading one article in the current property magazine or in the financial review or going to a seminar that talks about the hotspots. You know, the thing about a hot spot is that it's hot because there's a flame underneath it. You take the flame away and it becomes a cool spot. And that's what happened. People go and buy these in these areas that have some great, fantastic marketing concepts behind them, and they get you to buy a property that in the end, you know, may some students that have you know, come to you a while after purchasing that type of property have got properties that are worth less than their mortgage.
I was looking at one this morning with one of my students who were reviewing his portfolio, and there was one particular property that I said, well, God, you know, this is the one you got to sell. But it had no equity in it. It would have meant a loss to sell it. It was going to go nowhere in the next couple of years, and it was negative cash flow, about $8,000 a year. But it was just that, you know. He was sold on the marketing dollar and the what's going to happen and how much it's going to grow. And as soon as the marketing dollar moves on, the price of the property drops. And they typically sell you into these things at 110 or 120% by the time you pay their marketing fee and the stamp duties and everything else. So, you know, you're behind the eight ball for a good while, even after, as soon as you bought the damn thing.
There's an article recently in the local paper up here, and it was about some people that had bought properties off the marketeers for over $600,000, and they dropped in value by about $100,000 after the marketeers left. And the article was actually blaming Aldi because they built an Aldi at the end of the street.
That's a good thing.
It's not Aldi that created the problem. It was the marketeers and the overpricing and creating their own really their real hotspot when there wasn't really one there.
Yeah.
So what I like about the fact is that now when it comes to due diligence, I'm completely in control of my own research. And you know, so if I want to go researching a suburb and I specifically look at one suburb and I become an expert in there, I want to know everything that's going on. I want to know whether there's police reports that are happening. So what's the crime rate? What's the demographic of the area? How many married couples are there? How many singles are in the area? How many people own homes? How many people rent homes? What's the median rent? What's the median house price? What's the type of product in that market that's the most voluminous? So, you know, is it a 4x2-bedroom house, or is it a unit with three bedrooms, one bathroom and one car spot? You know, all those things are the important for me to do due diligence on an area before I can even think about looking at purchasing a property.
Even things like days on the market and clearance rates at auctions and how many properties are actually on the market at any point in time and what kind of properties they are. You know, are they units? Are they three bedders, four bedders, et cetera, which ones sell faster? Even down to what kind of, you know, what real estate agents sell more of what style of properties, because then you know who to go to buy and who to go to sell, because you want the crappiest real estate agent for the ones that when you're buying who don't know the market, or they're out of town, or they're off somewhere else, or whether, you know, when you're selling, obviously you want the switched on one. You want the one that specializes in that market, in that area, with that style of property. And you really want, you know, the best agent there from a closing perspective.
So there's a good point in there about a voluminous market. For some of you, you might be buying in, you know, and Dipner always says that real wealth comes from accumulation. You might be buying into a town to do something to a property, a strategy, to create your own little mini boom in there and revalue it. And from a bank perspective, that doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how many properties are on the market for sale as long as you're only revaluing. But if there's a heap of properties on the market for sale, well, the last thing you want to do is go and do a strategy in buying a property that you have to resell when there's another 100, 200 in an area. I was looking last night in some of the regional towns, and there was one specific student that wanted to buy in an area, and we looked at that area, and instantly I could see that it was 200 for sale of that type of product. That's not something you want to compete against.
No.
At the same token, the rents are exactly the same. So if there's not many rents on the market, especially for the type of product you want to produce, then if there's heaps on there, you don't want to try and compete against other people, because in the end, you're going to have to drop your rents. It's one of the important things that that Dimpner taught me, was that sometimes, you know, holding out for $10 a week rent every week, and I'm going off course here, but holding out for $10, you could wait 2 weeks trying to get your $10 instead of just dropping it by $10 and have it rented immediately. When you work out the maths on that, sometimes you've got to wait half a year plus to get your money back because you've waited 1 week. You've missed out on $200 or $300 rent.
Mm.
Now, with those markets, you know, finding out exactly what product, like I've said earlier, is going to be best for the market is the way to go. You might find that, you know, doing specific strategies of doing single room rental or creating something that's a potential to get more rent is the way to go. And that's the part of researching those suburbs that is important.
That's right. You know, when you start doing analysis on properties, I think people rush in too quickly and they don't do their numbers on a property. There's too much heart gone into the deal. When really, you know, people have this attitude of, oh, if I don't get this one, I'm going to miss out. You know, I've missed out or I'm missing the boat or whatever. When that's not the case at all, you know. That's a very lack attitude, as I say. And I say that to a number of people. And I think I offend them when I say it. But it's true. You know, there's plenty of deals out there. You are far better to sit back, work out exactly what you want, what it's going to look like, what kind of price point, secure the deal. What do I say is put your foot on the deal and then get in and do all of the real nitty-gritty due diligence on the actual property itself. But do the due diligence on the area first, even before you really start looking for a particular deal.
Yeah, one of the great success stories in the last couple of years has been a couple called Faye and Andrew. They're not in a relationship. They actually met through a through the members' website and struck up a partnership as joint venture partners. Faye, very low equity, very low income, not well at all, but she did her due diligence in the area and she was very patient. She did 50 feasibilities with the feasibility program that DIMPA provides over 9 months. Now most people would have probably given up at 10, 15 and moved to the next area or the next area.
Disheartened, yeah. Or given up totally.
And so she continued and so she did all the research and the numbers, and Andrew's a builder by trade and so he was the doing. And they then found another joint venture partner, which was a money partner.
So again, through the website.
Through the website. And so when you look at that, the three things that are important for your wealth and your happiness is time, energy and money. So Faye had the time, Andrew had the energy, and the other joint venture partner had the money. So together that made a really great relationship for them to move forward. But her due diligence over that 9 months was researching the area, knowing the zonings, knowing what the council wanted, knowing what the planners said you could or couldn't do, what land size was available to be subdivided, what you could do with old houses, how many units you could build on certain blocks. But she did it all in one area. And the outcome of all that due diligence was that as soon as she saw a deal come up, she was on it straight away. And that's what Tim was talking about, that some students don't allow the time to actually see what's right in front of them. They're too busy to go, well, this one doesn't work and that one doesn't work and I can't do anything with that.
They jump in to a deal and you know, don't do all the due diligence on it.
Yeah, or they hear the guy down the pub has told them this is the next up-and-coming area and off they go.
Mate at the pub.
Yeah, and, you know, you might go and buy a big block of land that you could subdivide by thought. But when you go and do the research, you know, you buy the harsh part of it will be you might go off without education, buy that property, think that you can subdivide it, you take it to the council and the council goes, well, it's in a flood zone, or you've got a covenant over the top of it, or there's a big power line that's going to run through there in the future, a stormwater or a road.
Zoning's wrong.
Yeah, or the zoning has just changed back to what, so that you can't do that now. And, you know, you just never know.
Mm. And that's, I really can't stress this enough. You know, there's so much due diligence that needs to be done on every single deal that you do. And it's really the more you do before you find the deal, the less you have to do once you've got the deal. Because then the only due diligence you've got to do is the due diligence on that particular property, not the area, the type, the strategy, the council, all the peripheral stuff, which is equally as important, if not more important, than the individual little property. And this is where you really need to take a step backwards to get that stuff in place before you even start doing any kind of due diligence on a particular property. While we're on a particular property, things like your pest. Let's talk about termites. They're one of your favourite subjects.
Yes, termites are a great thing, a great tool for you to be able to get into properties cheaper. Termites and asbestos is one of those things where it scares the main consumer. When they see a report that says either one of those, they automatically think that it's going to cost a packet load of money and that you shouldn't go into that property and buy them. you know, with the building inspections, and we've done a podcast on the sort of thing that you should be looking for on that, it gives you the advantage of actually going in there and saying, well, hang on, you know, there is some timber that's been eaten out here, and as long as the house isn't falling over, a decent builder or carpenter could go in there and say, oh, look, yeah, we need to replace some sticks of timber in there. And so when I say sticks, you know, framing and studs, we'll have to cut the wall open. We'll have to replace those studs in there and let's put it back in and patch it. Now, that you might get $10,000, $11,000, $12,000 off a property, but it may only cost $1,000 or $2,000 to fix that, plus the treatment of the termites. So you might put a baiting system in, or you might put a chemical barrier in. You know, there's lots of different options depending on the type of build.
You know, you say you might get $10,000 or $12,000 off. You and I both know of a deal last year where one of the students got something like $150,000 off for exactly that, and it cost them less than $10,000.
That's right. So, and in that particular deal, you know, they got $150,000 off. It cost them less than $10,000 to replace a bearer that was underneath, which meant that the floor was propped back up into its original position, and then they put it back on the market. I think they made $100,000 in the space of 3 months. Like, that's exactly a fast profit deal. Mm. And, you know, the same thing with asbestos. Asbestos is a very dangerous fibre that can do lots of damage. As long as you don't treat it poorly, then you're okay with it. And, you know, and when it comes to asbestos again, you might get 20 quotes to remove asbestos. You'll get one at $200 and one at $2,000. It's just that varied in the way that people are quoting. And you need a licensed person, obviously. That's a very important thing.
Even things like the building inspection report, there's a lot of things in there which can appear to a novice to be extreme. But in reality, it might only be, you know, $5,000 to fix, but that can actually result in a reduction in the purchase price quite substantially. I remember 1 year ago, it was actually a retaining wall that it was a fairly low-end property, and I think they ended up getting like $130,000 off to get this retaining wall fixed because the council had said that it needed to be fixed. Well, the fix-up job, I think, cost less than $10,000 again. Ultimately, they went for another 10, 12 years before anything actually needed to be done further on that retaining wall. But it was a big issue that everybody was concerned about. And the actual contract, that property had fallen over a number of times simply because people didn't do enough due diligence around what actually was the problem. It reminds me of another student in Sydney where they bought a block of land in a very nice suburb called Leichhardt. And on that particular property, there's very, very few blocks of land available in Leichhardt, as you can imagine. And on this particular property, everybody, you know, the contract had fallen over four or five times before they actually bought it. And the reason for that was that the neighbours objected to absolutely everything. So by having a better approach to design and taking into account all of the objections that were actually put up by the neighbour, they were able to get a development application through, a building approval through on the property. And I think on that deal, they made something like $300,000 or $400,000 on that particular property simply because they knew enough, they were educated enough to work through all of the issues associated with the due diligence.
So a building inspection is put in place by the purchaser to try and devalue the property. That's plain and simple. Hmm. And so when you go to purchase one and you see that type of report, you're quite scared about that. And as a seller, I really dislike them. As a seller, I had one in New South Wales where the report came in, and we're talking about a very low-end property. It was about $300,000 in value. And they absolutely shot the house to bits. It was on the edge of a mangrove area, so, you know, let's call it a swamp. And the report said things like, wait till you hear this one, that the washers in the toilets were leaking, so that was leaking water through the toilets. So rather than saying repair of the washers needed to be done, which was a cost of $20 or $30, well, maybe $50, I am a plumber after all, they said, well, you need to replace the whole toilet system, which was $2,000 a unit. So that was $6,000 to replace three toilets, and it cost me $2.50 for a washer, and I should have replaced them beforehand, but that's a plumber's life, isn't it? And so in the end, this young couple who were buying this property for their first home saw for a $300,000 property that the building inspector had said that there's $70,000 or $80,000 worth of repairs, and that wasn't the case. It was a good property for that valued property. And so be sure that you use it to your advantage and use that that you can get reduction in prices using it. And remember, when you're using it as purchaser, that you use it to understand and not be scared away from property.
Now, there are some building inspectors that are excellent to use when you're buying a property, because they'll point out every single little flaw in the property, like the $6,000 repair for a $2.50 washer.
Yeah.
And that's a good bargaining tool to go back and reduce the purchase price on the property. However, that's not the building inspector that you want as a seller. So there are other building inspectors that are a little more broad brush, and they're the ones you want to be using and even provide for you, for the purchaser, on your property. And you pick and choose as you go along.
Yeah, there's a couple of companies now. As a seller now, I don't sell many properties anymore. I try and keep them all. But as a seller, there's a few companies that you can get a building inspection done, and you pay them to do that, and they'll release the report to you. You'll have a look at it, you see if you're happy with it, and then when people are coming to inspect, they can then go and buy that same report for $100 or $250. It might cost you $600-$700 to get it done, but then every other purchaser that comes through can choose to purchase that one for $100 or $200. So instead of buying $500.
It also gives you the opportunity, if you get one done yourself, to go, oh, gee, well, maybe I should fix this and that, and then get a new one done to show that that's then been fixed.
Yeah, and that's a really good tool for you to be able to move forward and to be able to market your property and that comes with it, of making sure that you're putting something to the market that's going to sell.
Another thing that I want to bring up is the finance clause, because a lot of people just say subject to finance full stop, or subject to finance within 21 days or something like that. Well, that's really not good enough. You normally need to say who the finance is going to go through, and you might need to name an institution. I don't like that personally. It's none of their business. I certainly don't like naming how much I'm going to borrow. But if you put in words such as sufficient to complete with a financial institution, that's normally enough to cover that. And the other thing is that you want to make sure that it is finance approval to the buyer's satisfaction. I had a client a number of years ago who she contracted on a property in New Zealand, actually it was, but it makes no difference what country it was in. And it was a block of four units, and it was a great property, great cash flow on the property, and she put a contract on it subject to finance. And I do not like anybody buying a property that they haven't seen. I totally disagree with it anywhere in Australia, let alone overseas. So she, of course, secured the property. Then she went off to go and have a look at the property. And it was a good enough property. It was pretty much what was represented on the internet. But what wasn't represented on the internet was the fact that the street over had been completely burnt out. And when she made inquiries as to why that was the case, there's a biker gang in New Zealand called the Mongrel Mob, apparently. And the Mongrel Mob had a bit of a gang war and had burnt down the street. And most of the people that were living in the street over are now living in her street, and including in her property, or the one she was going to buy. So she decided, well, she was going to pull out of the contract based on the finance clause. But, of course, she just had subject to finance, not subject to finance to the buyer's satisfaction. So then what happened was that the seller said, oh, well, look, you can't actually pull out on that clause because I'll lend you the money at 10% interest. So the only way she actually ended up getting out of the contract, because legally she was bound to it, was that she cried for about 2 hours solid. And the seller took pity on her and let her out of the contract.
Yeah. So that's the number one rule that Dimmer has always said. Is you number one rule of due diligence is you go and see the property.
Yeah.
Don't rely on anyone else giving you information. I've made enough friends in the game to be able to go and look at stuff for me and give me some feedback, but I don't want them to make a choice on my behalf. One, because it puts pressure on them, and secondly, if it makes a mistake, then it could ruin our relationship for the future. So I want to go out, I want to touch and feel and make sure that it's right for me.
Mm, that's right, and the whole area, not just that particular property. Very important. Okay, Ian, well, we better leave it there, because otherwise we could go on all afternoon talking about due diligence and properties and real estate and all the things that we like to talk about. So thanks, guys, for listening. I hope that's helped you a little bit and give you a few pointers. And remember that, this is an ongoing journey, and I really want to see every single one of you in my boot camps and really getting on top of things from an ongoing learning perspective. get onto the members only website. Get yourself a member, make yourself a member, get onto the members only website, start communicating, start sharing ideas and talking to coaches and all the other good stuff there, and I want to see you at a boot camp. So guys, thanks heaps. Hope that's helped a little bit, give you a few pointers. Thanks again, Ian.
Thank you.
Very good, and we'll catch you again soon. Bye for now.